going to pay for it. And they're like, whoa, we can't afford that. You know? So.
Good morning. We can all take our seats this morning. Morning. Welcome to the August 17th, 2022 meeting of the Board of Directors of the Eastern Municipal Water District. We always start our meetings off with the salute to our flag. Alan, I understand we have a member of our Youth Ecology Corps who is going to graciously lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance this morning. Please come on up.
Ready? Begin.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you very much. Well done. May I ask the board secretary to inform the public on our virtual meeting information and then to call the roll of the board, please.
Absolutely. To avoid creating acoustic feedback, please mute all your devices during the meeting unless you are speaking. Before speaking, please unmute your device and turn down the volume of any other devices that are near you and tuned into the meeting. If you are joined by phone and would like to comment on an item, please press star 9 to let our staff know and wait to be notified. When it is your turn to speak, you will hear a notification asking you to unmute your phone by pressing star 6. If you have joined by computer, you may use the chat feature in Zoom to indicate your desire to speak. When done speaking, please mute your device again. Please participate from a quiet environment so that the board can hear you when you are speaking. Now we will do the roll call. President Pauly.
Present.
Director Record.
Here.
Director Corona.
Here.
Director Slauson.
Here.
Director Armstrong.
Here.
And our legal counsel is present here in the boardroom.
Very good. With that, we have public comment. Do we have anybody this morning that has filled out a card wishing to address the board?
We do not.
Very good. We will now go to our board reports, and we will start with Mr. Mowad. I'm sorry. I missed a section, important section, our Youth Ecology Corps. Alan, if you could come forward. This is one of my favorite programs as a board member, and we do a great job in recognizing them every year. So the floor is yours, sir.
Thank you so much. Thank you, President Pauly and members of the board. It is a pleasure to acknowledge the completion of our 24th cohort for the Youth Ecology Corps program. We have had 9 Youth Ecology Corps interns so far this year, bringing our total to over 200 participants since the program began 9 years ago, and that today we are recognizing 4 participants. The program is sponsored by the Riverside County Workforce Development Board and California Family Life Center. I'd like to introduce representatives from both. We have Mary Jo Ramirez, from the Executive Director for CFLC. We have Greg Snow, Program Coordinator from CFLC. Career Navigators, Rafaela Pelosos. Yes, I'm going to get that right one day. Business Liaison, Antonio Mateo. And from Workforce Development Board, we have Jamil Dada. And Jamil, would you like to come up and say a few words about the program? Thank you.
They never refuse a chance to speak.
I know you're tired of me coming and saying the same stuff, but
never.
Thank you, Chairman Pauly. Apprenticeship programs are the rave right now. They're nationwide. Federal focus on it, state focus on it, because everybody's realizing that the young folks don't need to go through to 4-year university and come out and not have a job and have $100,000 in debt. So a lot of the younger folks are doing associate's degrees or not even going to college. After high school, they're getting into apprenticeship programs. So and traditionally in the past, apprenticeship programs have always been trade-related with the labor unions. But now we're expanding apprenticeship programs in every job classification, in every industry. And I want to tell you, as a member of the Governor's State Workforce Board for the last 19 years, I always talk about your program at the state conference, at the state meeting. And this is one of the best pre-apprenticeship programs in the state, what you have done. You have made a difference in the lives of 200 young people that deserve an opportunity. So I want to thank you for doing that. and we're going to continue to do that again today with these four. But I also want to thank Joe Mawad and all of you again for continuing to not just support the Youth Ecology Program, but every year we do the Character Excellence Youth Award Ceremony, which is the County Youth Award Ceremony. I know Director Slauson attended it 3 weeks ago, and you always sponsor that as well. So I want to thank you for continuing to do this, and let's keep it going. And we're trying to expand this pre-apprenticeship program in other places. So thank you all. Thank you so much.
All right.
Can I answer any questions about any of this?
Okay. I have none other than thank you for your leadership on this. I think this is one of the premier things this water district does, and I thank you for being a leader in it, and I think we will continue to do it for many years to come.
Thank you, and thanks for the opportunity for these young kids. Mm-hmm. If I may, real quickly, because when I see Joe's face, I think about March Air Reserve Base. After I leave here, I'm having lunch with the brand-new commander at March. I know some of your issues are complex, but you're working aggressively to do great stuff on behalf of the Air Force, which is well recognized at the Pentagon. I know that when you visit D.C., you're working on it too. So I will make sure that to connect you with the new commander as well, and I've already talked about it, and we're going to discuss your project when I see him today. So thank you again for working with March to resolve the water issue there. Thank you again.
Thank you, Jamil.
Thanks, Jamil.
Thank you very much, Jamil. So at this time, I'd like Director, President Phil Pauly and Joe Mawad, if you just stand up here. We're going to bring in our Youth Ecology Corps interns and talk a little bit about them. So first up is Carlos Garcia. So I'm going to embarrass Carlos real quick. So Carlos has been working in our Development Services Department. This is his first cohort with us here at EMWD. He has been working on the recycled water meter applications for service, reviewing frontage documents for plotting in EMWD's GIS system, and updating spreadsheets. Carlos has done an amazing job, this cohort. Thank you so much. And we're bringing him back to do a second cohort in September. Congratulations, Carlos.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Every year we take a group of students to Washington, D.C. in September, and Carlos is going with us in 2 weeks.
All right.
So they get a tour of the White House, a tour of the Pentagon, a tour of the Library of Congress, a tour of the Supreme Court, a tour of the Capitol, a tour of the nighttime tour of all the memorials, a visit with the Department of Labor, and actually they get to meet five of the members of Congress. I just bring them in the office, they do the briefings, and every time I go subsequently, members always ask me, when are you bringing the youth? That's our favorite trip. So you'll be joining us in Washington, D.C. in 2 weeks. So.
All right, so next up I have Christopher Larry. This is Christopher's first cohort here with the Youth Ecology Corps program at EMWD. Christopher works in our Development Services Department. He's been working on the City View program, assisting new projects, creating maps, and working in the Real Quest requests. He has done an amazing job, and we're offering him to come back for a second cohort. Great job, Christopher. Congratulations. Okay, next up we have Maxwell Rodriguez. All right. So Maxwell, he works in our contracts department in the energy program. This is his second cohort in the Youth Ecology Corps program. Maxwell has been working on updating the energy use data in the energy management application, which is a very large project. He's also had the opportunity to learn about the fundamentals of EMWD's renewable self-generation installations like solar, microturbines, fuel cells, and this is Max's second cohort with us. He's done such an amazing job, and we're bringing him back for a third cohort. Congratulations.
Congratulations. Thank you.
Definitely not least is J.J. McCorley. You might recognize J.J. This is her second Youth Ecology Corps intern here her third cohort. You're the second that we've offered the program to. This gives J.J. 1 year of work experience here at EMWD. She currently works in our engineering services department. She's been working on providing fundamental GIS support, including performing data quality control, editing tasks, and records research for helping maintain data accuracy. JJ, it's been an absolute pleasure working with you, and I wish you all the best. Thank you very much. So in closing, I would like to thank the EMWD supervisors who are actively involved in the Youth Ecology Program. Without them, we couldn't do this program. They spend a lot of time mentoring and training these young adults. Also like to thank our general manager, Joe Mawad, and of course the entire board for the continuous support of our Youth Ecology Corps program. Thank you so much.
Any board members have any comments on this program before we move on?
I think JJ was at the character counts. Jamil, was JJ one of the character counts?
Yes.
Okay, so I do remember her. I went over and introduced myself. She represented EMWD well.
Right. She got a $2,500 scholarship. So that at that event every year, as you know, we give 10 $2,500 scholarships.
Yeah. And they're all well-deserving. They all do very well. Very impressive.
Very good. We will now move on to our executive reports, and just after executive reports, we are going to move on to informational item A because we have a very special speaker this morning. But before that, Mr. Mawad, welcome and good morning.
Good morning, President Pauly, members of the board. My report is included in your packet. Under new and ongoing items, as you're aware, last Thursday, Governor Newsom released his California Water Supply Strategy document, entitled Adapting to a Hotter, Drier Future. It builds upon his previous water resiliency portfolio that was released in July 2020. There's a number of important elements in his strategy outlined last week. For one thing, the governor has indicated that conservation alone is not enough to address and adapt to the current realities that we're dealing with relative to the drought. There's a call to create an additional 4 million acre feet of storage, both surface and ground storage. There's a strategy to enhance recycled water up to an additional 800,000 acre feet by the year 2030. There's also a call to free up an additional 500,000 acre feet by water use efficiencies and conservation, as well as making new available water via capturing stormwater and desalination, be it brackish groundwater or ocean. You know, one thing to note is that on all these items that I just mentioned, Eastern has long been a leader, whether it's recycled water, brackish desalination, water use efficiency, stormwater capture, all the above. And we're very proud of our history in investing in those efforts, and we applaud the governor for taking this next step. There's no specific budgetary allocations in the strategy. However, it does call for an additional $2.8 billion in fiscal year 2022-2023, which apparently will be allocated to address water supply relief and drought relief, including conservation, environmental protection, as well as other long-term infrastructure projects. The governor has also committed to streamlining the regulatory process, as well as promoting his strategies with the agencies throughout the state and local agencies as well. So we will continue to monitor this effort, and we will be informing our legislative representatives as well as local stakeholders as far as our priorities and our objectives going forward. Next, I wanted to share with the board that last Thursday as well, we had an opportunity, myself and staff, to brief Congressman Takano on the PFAS regulatory changes that have recently come about. As you're aware, the EPA recently reduced the federal health advisory to essentially a fraction of what it was previously. So we had an opportunity to brief Congressman Takano on the PFAS contamination that is south of the March Air Reserve Base that has impacted our Well 59 as well as our Well 56 and other potential sources of supply, as well as the EPA's proposed CERCLA hazardous substance designation for PFAS. We made it clear what our position and recommendation is in terms of making sure water utilities are exempted from any kind of CERCLA liabilities. Congressman Takano was very engaged in the conversation, asked a lot of really insightful questions, and he was very appreciative of everything that EMWD has done, and he has also offered his support in our ongoing discussions with the U.S. Air Force relative to the impacts of the PFAS plume. So it was a really productive conversation. Next, I wanted to follow up briefly with the board. The last board meeting, staff presented an update on the Doheny Ocean Desalinization Project and the potential for participation in that water supply opportunity. Based on the feedback we heard from the board, staff has scheduled a follow-up meeting with the Metropolitan Water District of Orange County, as well as the South Coast Water District. That meeting is scheduled on August 24th to discuss the concept of advancing a letter of interest. To that end, we will be bringing forward to Executive Committee tomorrow authorization for the General Manager to give me the ability to negotiate and develop a letter of interest to see if there's a way we can participate in that ocean desalinization effort. So we'll have that discussion with the Executive Committee tomorrow. Based on that feedback, we maybe bring that item back to the board during the first board meeting in September. Under items of interest to the board, I wanted you to be aware that on August 4th, I presented to the Ruler County representatives of California. This was at the recommendation of AQUA. We were provided an opportunity to share with that association, which consists of seven county supervisors throughout the state. We were able to share all of the initiatives and efforts that EMWD has been able to advance relative to water banking, recycled water, and groundwater brackish desalinization, as well as our efforts to secure funding, external funding, for those initiatives. It was really well received, a lot of interest from the membership, and there was interest to possibly even tour some of our facilities and learn more about what EMWD has done. So there may be more to come on that front if they do decide to come down and tour our facilities, and I'll keep you updated accordingly. And the last item I wanted to share with you is tomorrow I will be holding a all-hands meeting with the staff. It will be a hybrid, both in-person and virtual, essentially updating all of our teams on the latest that we're endeavoring to achieve, all of our initiatives, the drought conditions, water supply, our proposed succession plan initiative, and other issues that are pertinent to our employees. So I will be holding that meeting tomorrow. We're also going to be, subsequent to that meeting, we're going to be deploying to all district issues phones to all of our employees an application to help report any water waste. So as our employees are in the community. If they see any type of water waste, they'll be able to quickly send the location and a picture of that and make sure our conservation team addresses it. With that, I'll be happy to answer any questions the board may have.
Any questions on Mr. Director Armstrong?
Do you have any update on the negotiations on the Colorado River?
So basically what I've seen, Director Armstrong, is yesterday the Bureau did release their operations plan for 2023, and they identified the reductions for Nevada, Arizona, as well as Mexico, anticipated next year. But beyond that, the negotiations among the seven states continue. I did have a chance to briefly talk to the Metropolitan General Manager, and obviously he couldn't share a lot of details due to the closed session nature. But I think everyone's still hopeful they can get there. There's been various proposals put forward. Obviously, what we read in the paper is a lot of posturing and positioning between the lower basin states and the upper basin states. So there's still more work to do, and I think they're hopeful that those conversations and discussions can ultimately result in a consensus agreement on the reductions that are needed beyond what was spelled out by the Bureau yesterday in their press release.
You know, Joe, if you don't mind, I'll just add to that. I don't know if you've seen the letter that John Ensminger, the general manager of Southern Nevada Water Authority, wrote, but I'll make sure that all the board gets that. But to me, it's a very sobering opinion about where we're at and really a lack of progress. So I think it's very good context.
Yeah, I would just comment that I think it's a great idea that you have, that you inform all the employees. So I'm sure they get asked questions all the time. And if you're not working in the right department, you don't know all the answers. Right. It happens to me. But you mentioned the water wasting reporting.
Yes.
Keep me informed on that, because my wife is always calling me, taking pictures and saying, where do I report this? Look at this. No, and I have to check out which agency it's in, San Bernardino, Riverside, City.
Well, and this is specifically for our service area.
Right, right.
But
that
we'll
nice
make sure the app is on your phone as well, Director Slauson.
Any other questions for the general manager? All right.
Thank you
very much. We'll move on. Laura, good morning. Do you have anything for the board?
Nothing this morning. Thank you.
Very good. Nick, anything for us?
Yes, President Pauly, if I could, I'd like to share with the rest of the board that I had the pleasure of joining you and Roxanne Roundtree from our PGA department last night at the City of Murrieta Council meeting, where they were taking up consideration of the Los Alamos Hills ARPA-funded reimbursement agreement between the city and the city. And I want to share that not only was there overwhelming support from the City Council in supporting this partnership that we have with the city to address the community water needs, but also there was a great appreciation by the City Council for President Pauly and supporting this effort and this board's support on this effort, as well as overwhelming community response and support of us moving forward, as we had over 20 speakers from the community, multiple household members, but in my estimation is it's probably at least a dozen properties representing and very, very appreciative of us moving forward with this. So we're off to a good start here. We've already begun the engineering effort to design and construct the infrastructure, and now we need to more directly engage with the community to identify those who are truly interested in committing and connecting so that we can move forward with the LAFCO and annexation process. But I thought it was a great response last night, and it was a pleasure joining you at that meeting.
I will just add it's not every day you can go to a public meeting and get a standing ovation after an item has passed. And then Nick and Roxanne and I were followed out to the parking lot by many of the residents profusely thanking us. So that made me feel really good that we're doing the right thing to bring water to this community that is having some very distressed well situations right now. So I kind of think that's what we do here. And it's always nice to be recognized and appreciative. So, Nick, thank you for that. And great job on your team for moving that forward. So appreciate it. Good morning.
Good morning. And nothing from me this morning, President Pauly.
Very good. Matt?
Yeah, good morning. I don't have anything this week either.
All right. Very good. Thank everybody. We are now going to move to informational item A on our agenda. We'll come back to the consent calendar. But Jolene Walsh, are you joining us virtually and can introduce our guest speaker?
Yes. Good morning, President Pauly and members of the board. Today we get to hear a very timely presentation from Jennifer Pierre, the general manager of the State Water Contractors, which is an entity comprised of the 27 public water agencies that work together on water supply and environmental issues in and around the Delta. A Metropolitan Water District is a member of the State Water Contractors on behalf of EMWD and its other member agencies, so we get the benefits of Jennifer's great work through MET. Jennifer's career has been dedicated to managing complex and challenging water supply and restoration issues in the Bay Delta, which I imagine is pretty frustrating at times, but she's definitely one of California's top experts on the Central Valley Project and the State Water Project. And Jennifer, we're really grateful that you're here to discuss the latest efforts in the Delta with us. So thank you. And I think Randy may want to say something as well.
Just also want to welcome Jennifer. It's been my pleasure to have worked with her over the past several years, and really appreciate her work on Bay Delta issues, especially her ability to collaborate with different interests and try to build consensus. So welcome, Jennifer. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm not able to start my video, so I don't know if you guys want to see me, but you can if someone wants to change that. Otherwise, I'll jump into my presentation. I've been working on the Delta Conveyance Project since 2011. I don't spend my day-to-day on it anymore, but my background with this project is my degree is in conservation biology, and I was a consultant to DWR leading the development of the Bay Delta Conservation Program beginning in 2011 when Governor Brown took office. Since then, I've been working at the State Water Contractor since 2017, and of course, this is a very critical project to the State Water Contractors, 18 of which are contributing to planning funding to advance this program. And I think that, in kind of reflecting over the last 11 years of my direct involvement with the project, and of course, this is in concept has been pursued since, the 60s and really in earnest since the 80s, I think it's becoming sharper and clearer how important this project is relative to our climate change adaptation and mitigation for the State Water Project. I think that, it's been interesting to me to watch the modeling that we were doing back in 2011 and presenting that to the public and to other water agencies not involved in the project, and really a lot of skepticism around, what we were showing was going to happen, reservoir dead pools, crazy storms, prolonged dry drought, the change in from snowpack to precipitation. And unfortunately, that's become our lived reality. And the need for this project becomes, in my mind, clearer and clearer, because it's not just the modeling that's telling us we need this project, but it's actually the climate that we're all experiencing is telling us we need this project. So the purpose here of modifying the State Water Project in this way is to really take advantage of those changes that we're already experiencing so that we can move water when we're seeing these huge storm events and runoff events into storage and available for our use so that droughts like we're experiencing now are less impactful to our way of life. There's of course, earthquake risk in the Delta. I think that's been long identified as a concern. And, right now, State Water Project water and CVP water is moved north to south of the Delta through a series of levee channels. And while the state continues to be committed to maintaining these levees, the earthquake risk could put State Water Project supplies at a major risk for a prolonged amount of time. So having some redundancy in the Delta around the delivery of water is really critical. And then lastly, I think the sea level rise impacts, again, already experiencing changing the elevation at which we are able to divert our state water project water is going to help us mitigate against those impacts. So I think, again, this is all becoming a lot clearer of why we need this project. Next slide. One kind of data point that I think is very interesting, and I'm sure you've read about it, is that in December of last year, up in Northern California, we experienced substantial rain. In fact, we got 5 inches of rain in downtown Sacramento in 24 hours. It was that's where I live, and the streets are flooding. There was snow in the Sierras in some locations, but this was really an example of a storm that was, in fact, a lot of in-valley precipitation. And because of some of our rules in the South Delta, where we currently divert water, we were not able to take advantage of this huge storm that went on for about 2 weeks. And we calculate, and DWR calculates, that had we had the tunnel in place during that time, and we would have been able to move about 236,000 acre-feet of water in just that two-week period into storage south of Delta. And I think we can all acknowledge how critical every one of those drops would have been for managing through this year. And so when we look at the tunnel and its ability to take advantage of these sorts of storms, and again, this is meeting all the water quality and fisheries requirements in the Delta. So this is without any adjustments to, what are the required operations, this is a lot of water. And when we, even in a critical year like this, just demonstrates just how important this piece of infrastructure is. Next slide, please. We've been pursuing this project a really long time. I think there's often folks questioning, is this the correct way to spend money or to operate the system? And I think it's a good reminder that 1 in 12 Americans receive some portion of their water from the State Water Project. Obviously, 19 million of those are in Southern California, but I think when we look just at the magnitude of what this water delivery system is doing, it's important to think about these terms. And we also serve about 6 million disadvantaged community members. So about two-thirds of all disadvantaged communities are served some portion of their water supply by the State Water Project. So affordability in water delivery is very, very important to the agencies that are making investments in this project. And I think that, we need to make sure that Californians understand that their water supply is secure, is efficient, and that all of us leaders in the water industry are doing everything we can to protect the State Water Project investment that's been made. And that we're able to continue to operate it into climate change. And I'll talk about in a little bit how that relates to other investments that agencies are making. But in general, I think you all know that in order to do things like recycle water or manage for groundwater, including water quality or PFAS, or even to look at prudent investments in storage, you need to have a stable supply of water, and that's really where the State Water Project interrelates with those sorts of activities. Next slide. Looking at, what is the project, there's a couple alternatives, but the proposed project is what's called the Bethany Alignment, and this is a change from the previous California Water Fix and the Bay Delta Conservation Plan, in that instead of diverting water from the North Delta into the Clifton Court forebay and some new forebay alignments, it's being diverted directly into the aqueduct south of the Delta at Bethany Reservoir. The total capacity of the single tunnel is 6,000 CFS, but there are two proposed intakes of 3,000 CFS each. And we look at other alternatives and other alignments. The central and eastern alignments is noted on the map, 1, 2, or 3 intakes, a range of diversion capacity from 3,000 CFS up to 7,500 CFS, and then variations on pumping plants and forebay configurations in the South Delta. Next slide. We have been, and actually I would say DWR has been working incredibly hard to really modify this project to meet the governor's directive that he gave pretty much right when he came into office. Obviously, the project used to be two tunnels, and now it's one. And in doing so, you know, really kind of we were able to really look at different alignments and different ideas, including this Bethany Reservoir component, which is really critical to mitigating impacts on the land, as well as creating a true redundancy in the system. The project's been downsized. We've been working within the community. When I say we, I really mean mostly DWR. I want to make sure to give them a lot of credit. They are incredible leaders on this project, and they've really been working to understand what the on-the-ground impacts are and trying to really address and avoid impacts to the community. I think DWR has done a great job looking at, you know, where did we do things correctly with BDCP and water fix, and where did we need to improve, and figuring out how to efficiently use areas that were working and adjust areas that weren't. And again, just really looking at how to minimize impact. I think it's important, and next slide, please, to just recognize that this project is a very critical project for the state, again, serving 27 million Californians. But the impacts of the project really are primarily concentrated in communities that do not receive water from the State Water Project. So I think it's important for us to acknowledge that, you know, these impacts are real. This is where people live, do business, go to school. And I think DWR has taken seriously some of the major impacts that were identified in previous iterations of this project to try to really address those community concerns, including where launch shafts, where the construction equipment enters the tunnel and where the tunneling begins, to move them away from communities, to look again where the routes can avoid communities, undergrounding transmission lines to address some issues we had with the protected Sandhill Crane, avoiding some of the major highway throughways that would, you know, create major congestion. Similarly, on the water, avoiding barge landings, new barge landings that would create boating restrictions, and again, not constructing a forebay that instead using the existing Bethany Reservoir. Next slide. So DWR has been really ramping up community engagement. Some of this is due to kind of new legal requirements, but a lot of it is really in recognition of the need to really engage with communities that are impacted by this project, including disadvantaged communities, looking at various surveys and community engagement in a wide range of languages, extensive coordination with the tribal communities, and looking at what we call a tribal impact analysis and mitigation. So really looking at broad tribal resources and the Delta as a tribal resource, and making sure that we're addressing those concerns. And then working with the community to really focus in on where are the physical impacts of the project, how can we use design and engineering to avoid and minimize those. Next slide. Another community thing we are focused on is what's called a community benefits program. It is similar to other programs that have been developed, including in metropolitan service area, but really just acknowledging what I mentioned earlier, that we have impacts that are local to the Delta, even though the benefits are accruing across the state. So how do we try to address those local impacts? So, you know, there'll be some sort of Delta fund that will fund a community benefits program. We're looking at, you know, are there leave behind infrastructure, for example, things like Wi-Fi or improved transportation corridors. Looking at job training programs to really promote improved job opportunities in the Delta region. And, you know, DWR is looking at, it doesn't need to be Delta-wide. We can really look at individual towns or communities and their specific needs in developing this program. Next slide. I think you're aware that I'm sorry, was there a question? So I think you're aware that the draft EIR was released on July 27th, and there'll be a 90-day public comment period. I would really appreciate if Eastern supports this project, that you do make your voice heard, both officially through a CEQA comment letter, but also in any communications to your community so that they understand the value of this investment to Eastern and its service area. It's really important that people understand that. I think you know that oftentimes our communities don't really understand where our water comes from or how we're connected to different systems, and helping us help your service area understand the value to your area is really something that you could be helpful in doing if that's in fact your perspective too. In terms of the NEPA compliance, which we also need in order to support the ESA consultation, the Army Corps of Engineers is currently the lead agency on the development of the EIS, and they should be releasing that shortly, and it's very should be similar to the EIR and will be available for a review period itself. But we are hoping to complete the EIR and hopefully the EIS in fall of 2023. So that really concludes my presentation on the project, but of course I'm happy to answer any other questions that you have on the project. I did also want to mention in the governor's announcement and document that was released Thursday, this project was noted as one of the key elements of our climate change adaptation strategy. So we were very glad to see that recognized. We really appreciate his continued support for this project, as well as DWR's leadership in moving this project forward. And I think that it'll be important for us to make sure that as we move forward with this project and other investments, that we are stabilizing our regulatory framework within the Delta. And so another, you know, major aspect that we are working on is, of course, advancing the voluntary agreement to create that stability so that we can all collectively move forward on the suite of investments the governor is identifying need to happen for our climate resiliency. So I will leave it at that if there's questions. Thank you.
No, thank you. Thank you for sharing all that with me. Does members of the board have any questions or comments? Director Record?
No. Thank you, Jennifer, for doing the presentation. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
President Pauly, if I could add that staff intends to submit a comment letter on the draft EIR in support of the proposed project and highlighting the multiple benefits that Jennifer described to not only EMWD, but frankly the entire region and Southern California. So that we will be submitting that letter to the state accordingly.
Good. Let me chime in a second on that, though. For years, we were asked to support the twin tunnels, and I know our agency put ratepayer dollars in supporting the twin tunnels, put a lot of political effort into doing that. I want to feel comfortable, at least with me as a board member, that this is the real deal this time, because I am a little gun shy after the whole twin tunnel issue, and it is very important to me, and I think everybody in our community here, that we have a conveyance around the Delta. That is not the question, but I just want to put, for my comfort level, I want to make sure that this is the real deal that's happening, because I'm still a little gun-shy after the twin tunnel issue, and I'll just put that out there.
We appreciate the feedback. And Jennifer, I don't know if you're still online, but perhaps you can also describe potentially, you know, beyond the EIR, what would be the schedule for advancement of the project? I know there's a number of years for the engineering and then ultimately the construction, and then maybe the budget for this as well. I don't know if you can touch upon those couple of points.
So I can. We have about 2 years of permitting after, and we are completed with CEQA, but that's also when we expect a major ramp up in engineering design. And as I think you may be aware, there's a joint powers authority called the DCA that is kind of managing that design, and we'll really be able to ramp up once we're completed with the CEQA. As I mentioned, I think we have a lot of lessons learned in how we proceeded through the permitting process with Water Fixed, and I think that there remains commitment, as far as I can tell, across the state of how to get this project permitted in a timely manner. It's about 15 years of construction after that, so that's the rough schedule. There's no guarantee anything will happen in California in terms of water investments, but I feel that the need for this project is becoming so crystal clear that I think it's got the best shot it's ever had before. In terms of budget, the planning costs are currently paid for by the participating state water project contractors, and in 2020, they voted for either 2 years of funding or 4 years of funding, and if you voted for 2 years of funding, those agencies voted for an additional 2 years just earlier this year. So we have funding to complete the planning through 2024, at which point I think there'll be another assessment about where we are with permitting and moving the project forward and different financing opportunities. And that's something that there's a separate JPA, the finance authority, looking at different opportunities for financing once we really start ramping up on the construction and design elements. There was a cost estimate done for the project by the DCA back in 2020 to support that initial planning funding request by the participating agencies. And, you know, I think that until we have some more clarity on design, we want to, you know, we're not hyper-focused on that budget. But I do think that as we complete the CEQA, as more design is done, they're actually in the Delta now doing geotechnical work. We're going to have a lot more information to really refine what the overall cost of the project will be and the financing opportunities.
Thank you, Jennifer. Appreciate that.
Can I make a comment?
Sure.
I think we absolutely need to support the project and hope that it does get traction and it moves forward. And just want to, I wasn't on the board at Eastern when the last time around and the effort was made, but I did have an opportunity to witness our representative of MET when Randy was was the chairman of MET, and there was real leadership, and I think Randy drove hard to get a solution to this and move it forward. And it's unfortunate that we're kind of, you know, where we are now, but you know, so I'm just compliment you. I was able to sit in a couple of those the Inland Caucus meetings where you were taking this item to the board and you were telling the representatives there from the other agencies you're not gonna entertain any other motion other than to get this thing moving forward. And I mean, you were very assertive and leading on it, but it's unfortunate that we are where we are here now, but we need to keep moving it forward. So I support the letter to support this.
Appreciate that, Jeff.
It was fun. It's fun to watch.
Very good. Well, thank you again for joining us with that information. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
All right. That will bring us now to our consent calendar. Is there any members of the board that wish to pull an item for separate discussion or have a conflict with any item? See none, I will look for a motion and a second on our consent calendar.
I'll move it.
Moved by Director Record.
I'll second.
Second by Director Corona. May I get a roll call vote, please?
Director Pauly?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
That passes 5-0. That will bring us to item 5 on our agenda today, which is the action calendar. Item A is to approve and authorize a 5-year agreement with Xerox Business Solutions for a multifunction copier and copy center service in the full term not to exceed $2.1 million. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, President Pauly, members of the board. By way of background, in September 2016, the district entered into a 5-year agreement with Xerox Corporation for document production and equipment leasing services. This contract is more than just leasing copiers. It's a service-based contract with 3 full-time Xerox personnel staffed in our copy center, providing full service document production capabilities, special mailings on behalf of district staff, high-volume copying and printing, mail processing and distribution, document scanning services, and first-level support of existing Xerox multifunction devices and network desktop printers. In April of 2021, the board approved and authorized a one-year contract extension through the end of this November. The reason for the extension was to give staff an opportunity to assess copier use and requirements associated with staffing changes due to the COVID-19 pandemic. In June of this year, purchasing staff received six proposals in response to a RFP for district-wide multifunction device replacement managed print and copy center services. A cross-functional team of district staff reviewed the proposals based on a comprehensive set of criteria, which included price and payment terms, processes to complete work, project schedule, company qualifications and experience, contractual exceptions, proposed equipment, references, and insurance and safety record. And as shown on the bottom of page two, Xerox was the highest scoring proposer, providing competitive pricing and the best overall value to the district. So the range of pricing received in response to the RFP was very competitive with minimal variation. The evaluation team scored some of the companies lower in key categories for several reasons, including failing to acknowledge safety violations, refusing to meet district standard insurance requirements, taking significant contractual exceptions to district standards, subcontracting copy center personnel without proposing third-party resumes and background information on staff, using remote access tools that conflict with district information systems requirements, and not including key information on multifunction devices. In comparison, Xerox provided resumes for three employees that are currently working in the copy center and average about 18 years experience, and also provided the other information requested in the proposal. The scope of work includes replacing and updating the existing fleet of leased copiers with new and current technology. Supply chain issues have definitely impacted many industries, including the copier market, and proposers were asked to provide device lead time with their submittals. Equipment availability was a key detail in the evaluation in order to confirm that the companies could meet the current expiration date of November 30th. Xerox proposed an equipment lead time of 8 to 10 weeks, but the other companies did not propose lead time or commit to a delivery date of equipment. So with the recommended contract, Xerox will manage a district copy center using three full-time associates and provide document management services, which includes completing document production orders, scanning services, distributing internal district correspondence, picking up and delivering mail from the local post office, and providing maintenance and repair services on 64 Xerox multifunction devices and 17 non-Xerox network printers. District requirements include replacing the current fleet of 64 multifunction devices with new equipment. Many of these devices have reached their end of useful life and will be replaced with equipment with increased technology and capabilities. Historically, the equipment that Xerox has provided has had a 99% uptime. As previously indicated, district print and copy center utilization was evaluated prior to the release of the RFP and the following workplace changes resulting from the pandemic. A comparison of annual print volume is reflected at the table at the bottom of page three, and I'm pleased to report that the number of printed impressions has decreased steadily since 2019. Staff anticipate volume during the term of the upcoming five-year agreement to be comparable with the 2021 usage, totaling approximately 2.3 million images per year. While there has been a reduction in printed images, the cost of equipment, supplies, and labor has steadily increased the past few years. Average costs under the previous agreement were about $405,000 annually, with estimated costs of the new agreement at about $430,000 annually. This represents only a 6% increase from 6 years ago, which is low given current market conditions. Xerox has provided exceptional service, reliable equipment, and has previously been recognized as a District Supplier of the Year. At this time, our recommendation is for the board to approve and authorize a five-year agreement with Xerox Business Solutions for multifunction copier and copy center services in the full term not to exceed total of $2,150,000. I want to let the board know, too, that Chris Clark and Marcia Quo-Schmidt with Xerox are here in attendance today.
Very good. Thank you for joining us today. Appreciate it very much.
I'm happy to answer any questions you might have at this time.
Any questions on this item? I'm going to put you on the spot with a hypothetical one. How much paper are we going to be using 5 years from now? How many sheets?
I'm hoping for a reduction, President Pauly, based on some of the information services that we're getting into, our ERP implementation and a few others that we have
in the
works.
I'll give you an example. I like paper. I'm doodling on it, writing notes, so I'm not yet ready to give up my copy paper. So, very good presentation. If there's
I
no questions.
Staff's recommendation.
Moved by Director Corona.
Second.
Second by Director Slauson. May I get a roll call vote, please?
Director Pauly?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
That passes 5-0. Why don't we take a 10-minute break? We will come back and do the financing authority right after the break, and then we'll continue with our action items. Good.
Yeah. Good job.
I thought it was.
Reconvene our meeting.
Your mouth shut.
Yeah, I was looking at the bag.
It is the hour of 10 o'clock, and we have our Eastern Municipal Water District Finance Authority meeting, which I will now call to order. Is there anybody wishing to do public comment on this meeting?
No, there is not.
Very good. With that, our item is the approval of the minutes of the March 16th, 2022 Financing Authority Regular Meeting.
Make that
May
motion.
I look for a motion?
Make
Director
that motion.
Armstrong made a motion. Director Slauson, second. May I get a roll call vote, please?
Director Pauly?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
That passes 5-0. We will now go to our action items. We have none. We also need to get a motion to receive and file the Eastern Municipal Water District Financing Authority Fiscal Year 2022 Fourth Quarter. Does anyone need a report on this?
Move it.
Seeing none, moved by Director Record, second by Director Slauson.
Yes.
Second. May I get a roll call vote, please?
Director Pauly?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
That passes 5-0. With that, we will adjourn the meeting of the Eastern Municipal Financing Authority to Wednesday, August 16, 2023. We will go back now to our regular board meeting. We are at action calendar item B, which is to approve and authorize agreement of the Black and Veatch for Temecula Valley flow monitoring and model calibration and additional appropriation of $647,000. Good morning.
Good morning, President Pauly and members of the board. My name is Damian Betcher, and I'll be presenting on the proposed Temecula Valley sewer flow monitoring and model calibration project. Here's a brief agenda of the items that I'll be going over. We'll go over some background, the elements of the project, how we selected the consultant, and finally our recommendation. Previously, we performed a full round of flow monitoring for our entire district as a precursor to the 2015 Wastewater Master Plan, and we used the data that we collected to calibrate the model for that master plan, along with identifying certain capacity restrictions, and then used both of those to generate our current wastewater capital improvement program. Since then, there's been a fair amount of development in the district, as you're aware, but the flows have not increased quite as much as we anticipated, and this is largely due to conservation efforts that the district has made, which is good from a conservation standpoint, but it has resulted in increased wastewater nutrient concentrations at the treatment plants, which is causing them to behave a little bit differently than we expected. So with this project, we will develop a flow monitoring plan and place 55 flow meters in the Temecula area to collect data about flows and use that data, as I said before in the previous master plan, to calibrate our hydraulic model and also use it to look at different flow factors for houses and different land use types. Also assess inflow and infiltration during stormwater events to our wastewater system. Update our design criteria if necessary. And importantly, quantify that change in concentration of wastewater loading that we're seeing at the treatment plants. We will be doing that by targeting specific single-family residential areas of varying ages and doing composite sampling for those meters to have our lab analyze those samples and look at those concentrations and how they've changed over time. So we released an RFP to we released the RFP to four different firms, and we received proposals from three of those firms. Two of the firms partnered up, so that's why we got the three proposals, but it actually includes all four consultants. And we assembled a team of district staff from facilities planning, wastewater CIP, wastewater operations, and source control to evaluate the proposals. And we used these criteria to evaluate the firm's proposals. We looked at their understanding of the project, their proposed technical approach and scope of work, their safety records, the qualifications of both the team and the firm, and finally their proposed fees for the project. The evaluation team consisted of Laura Barraza, myself, Scott Tolland of engineering, David Trujillo of source control, and Jason Beard from wastewater collections. And these were the final rankings of the proposals. Four of the five of us had Black & Veatch ranked as number one, and the fifth had Black & Veatch tied for number one. And those placements are reflected in the ratings there. And you see the fees for the consultants in the final column there, with Black & Veatch coming in as the lowest fee. So our recommendation is for the board to approve and authorize a contract with Black & Veatch in the amount of $562,697 and a total appropriation in the amount of $647,100 to fund the project through completion. And with that,
and if you have any questions. Damien, we do have a representative from Black & Veatch with us today.
Kevin Davis is here.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you very much for being here this morning. I appreciate it. Any questions from board members on this item?
I'll move it.
Moved by Director Corona.
Second.
Second by Director Armstrong. May I get a roll call vote, please?
Director Pauly?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
Passes 5-0. And again, thank you, sir, for being here. Very much appreciated. With that, we'll move on to item C, which is to approve and authorize an amendment to the agreement with Jacobs for $313,000 for hydrogeological consulting services. Good morning.
Good morning, President Pauly, members of the board. I'm here to present on the hydrogeological consulting services. Excuse me, I'm Tom Henderson, and I'm the district's principal engineering geologist. So background, since I came to the district nearly 2 years ago, there's been a considerable backlog of groundwater development projects that have been going on for the district. That makes sense in light of the statewide drought that we have, and also the expansion of our water supply portfolio. You can see the increase in hydrogeology-based programs and projects that we have. Some of those include the Paris North program, work that we're doing on the east side with the Groundwater Reliability Plus program. We have a limited number of in-house hydrogeology staff, and so we have these ongoing technical support needs. Jacobs Engineering Group has been providing on-call assistance to our team since 2020, and they are one of two firms that support the groundwater group here at the district with hydrogeological services. I'll just point out that Mr. Alan Bradford is the project manager for Jacobs Engineering Group. He's here with us today.
Thank you for being here, sir.
So we do get a lot of external technical assistance to our staff. Some of that includes short notice field staff. When we have a request from a regulatory agency, for example, to go monitor water levels, we'll tap into those staff. Subject matter experts is something that we really rely on, whether it's groundwater modeling, regulatory concern, evaluation of contaminants, or even most recently utilizing their acoustic engineers to assess the amount of noise that we're making when we're drilling these larger wells. The environmental consulting expertise with management of those things that come up in environmental type work, whether it's managing materials that are generated or disposal. And then one of the probably the key things that they provide is peer review of work products by other consultants. So we have several things that are going on that are pretty big. One large one is obviously the Paris Desalter program. We're supporting the PWR brine pond monitoring well installation. We are supporting the groundwater reliability plus program. We provide support with respect to SGMA, GSP development, and GSP management. And then there's some smaller items such as the district's master well specifications, evaluation of historic data, those sorts of efforts. And so this slide here provides really, it's a summary of all the things that they may support our team with, either directly working in the field or in an on-call capacity with our staff. And so our recommendation is that the board approve and authorize the general manager or his designee to execute an amendment to the professional services agreement with Jacobs Engineering Group, Incorporated, for hydrogeological consulting services in an amount of $313,785, bringing the total agreement to an amount not to exceed $706,225. Thank you. I'll take any questions?
Good. Any questions from the board on this?
I have no questions.
I just had a quick one. So this modeling is going to take place outside the jurisdiction of the Hemet-San Jacinto Water Master because they're doing their own, correct?
And if I could, yes. President Pauly, the Water Master actually relies partly on our efforts. Okay. They build upon the modeling update. So the next update by the Water Master will rely on our update. And correct me if I'm wrong.
Correct. We look at the groundwater model on a physical basis throughout the watershed, and the Hemet-San Jacinto Water Master relies on the data, relies on the simulations.
Gotcha. Okay. Very good. With that, I'll look for a motion and a second on the item.
Move it.
Moved by Director Record.
Second
it. I get a roll call vote, please.
Director Pauly?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
And that passes 5-0. Thank you very much for the presentation. Again, thank you, sir, for being here. Always appreciated to have our vendors join us at the board meetings. We will now go on to informational item B, which is our customer service call center staffing update. Charles, you're going to give us this presentation this morning.
Well, Nicole and I, well, good morning, President Paul and members of the board.
Very good.
We appreciate this opportunity to deliver this presentation, some strategic staffing plans that have been in place for a number of years that we've been pulling this together, and we're excited to share those plans with you here this morning. So by way of background, this digital transformation that we all continue to experience is shifting the way consumers interact with businesses. And more what we're finding is customers are choosing to utilize self-service tools to perform tasks such as paying their bill, viewing water usage, and another host of transactions as opposed to calling call centers. Now, this is made possible due to the fact that they can access these tools using a smart device of their choice, as well as these tools are available anytime, day or night. Now, as we engage in this discussion, I think it's important to also note that work from home has been a very common practice in the call center industry even before the pandemic. We're all very familiar what happened in mid-2020. A lot of corporations were transitioning to work from home. But this has been the case in call centers way before that time. And really, the key drivers for this is, and you may know some of this information, call centers are very metric-driven and easily managed remote staff by way of the various performance dashboards and detailed reports and analytics that are commonly deployed in call centers. Additionally, staff that's working from home, their performance is monitored real time, allowing managers like Nicole and other managers to really quickly identify issues and put measures in place to address those issues. And, you know, in the coming slides, you know, Nicole will be talking a little bit about some of those tools that we have deployed here at Eastern. And then finally, the technology that is deployed for call center staff is easily deployed to remote workstation. And that was certainly the case when the Reno call center, Optimum CX, deployed their staff to work from home. In short order, they were able to quickly ramp up and have their folks back online assisting EMWD customers, and that has been the case to date. So with that, I'd like to pass the presentation on to Nicole, who will get into a little bit of the details regarding how we manage the EMWD call center, both in staff and the staff that's working from home, in addition to some of the future plans that we have for the department.
Very good.
Nicole.
Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, President Pauly and members of the board. So Charles touched on some of the technology that we're able to leverage to manage our staff, whether they are in the office, working from home, or remote like our third-party call centers. So this particular slide is our phone system, and you can see I can log in real time and see the state of any agent and what they are currently doing. We have, in this particular example, we have a couple of agents in research, which means they are offline and probably finishing up and wrapping up a call. I can see that this particular agent is in a break status. And then we can also see staff that are ready and waiting. So this particular agent is ready and available, waiting for the next call. I also can see that we have agents that are actively talking and supporting and assisting our customers. And additionally, we can see how long these particular agents are engaging or in a particular state. So again, we're able to monitor real time, which is very effective for us. And we can also quickly identify any issues. The team is very engaged and proficient with using the Teams tool. So if there are any concerns, they can either reach out directly through Teams. Leadership can reach out to Teams as well, and they also have the ability to contact a supervisor-supported line for any escalations that they might have. Additionally, we have what is called the Calabrio system, and this system is utilized for quality assurance and also supports us from a workforce staffing standpoint. All of our customer calls are recorded, and a percentage of them are evaluated for quality purposes. We want to ensure that our staff is representing EMWD and presenting our brand the way that we expect it to be presented. Workforce management, it also is utilized to forecast customer calls and predict required staffing levels so that we know, for example, that in January, high call volume, we know we need to ramp up and have more folks on the phones ready to assist those customers. This is a dashboard. A reporting dashboard that is available to not only leadership but also at the CSA level. And it is integrated with our phone call systems, so the numbers report in automatically. We're able to review our performance with staff directly, and this information is updated on a daily basis. You'll notice here I can also see the performance of the remote call centers, so all of their activity, the amount of calls that they've handled, and their performance overall. So the deployment strategy for work from home. All of our call center customer service advisors will work primarily from home. The district will provide the call center staff with the necessary equipment to minimize interruptions to live customer interactions. We didn't want call center staff relying on their own equipment because we wanted to ensure that the experience from our customers is not impacted in any way. There will be an internet stipend that is going to be provided to those staff to ensure that they have the proper internet speeds. We want to ensure someone doesn't, you know, that they have the bandwidth to support our calls as they come in. And we will continue to support customers that come into the front counter. So all customer service advisors will be required to work on site at the main lobby supporting those customers on a rotational basis. The rest of our leadership team, we will adhere to the existing and current district policy for work from home. So we've taken a phased approach in deploying our staff to work from home. We've just completed the pilot phase, which is phase one of five CSAs. They have actively been deployed, and they are working from home and taking our customer calls as we speak. We'll have a phase two in the upcoming weeks and deploy an additional 10, and then a final phase of the final nine CSAs in the upcoming weeks. As we deploy, and each day, we are actively going in to ensure that the program is effective and making any tweaks as necessary in case there are any challenges that we're running into. We want to acknowledge the partnership between the union leadership team. They played an integral role in connecting and partnering with us to ensure that the messaging was delivered and that we were on the same page. They attended the customer service department meeting where the work from home program was discussed with staff. They assisted with addressing CSA questions and preparing FAQs, and they were very supportive through the entire process. We wanted to acknowledge that. So what about the building? So for any of you who have visited us, we're down the road. EMWD does own three lots. Lot 7 and Lot 11 are the primary building where the call center staff and the billing and operations team are housed. And then we also own the Lot 8, which is highlighted in the blue there. So if we start to deploy folks from staff and our footprint isn't as heavy, what do we do? So some of the long-term plans, since there will be fewer staff reporting to the customer service building, there is the potential to relocate any remaining staff to EMWD headquarters here, and there's also the option to potentially sell the current customer service building or repurpose it for any future EMWD needs. So in summary, the overall staffing plan, transition all of our eligible EMWD call center staff to work primarily from home, not replace any existing or future vacancies of call center personnel until reaching a yet-to-be-determined level. So while we know that, you know, our service area is growing, you know, we think back to what Charles mentioned in terms of customers levitating and growing and adapting with self-service. We know that at some point, even with the growth, customers are going to start self-serving more, and those call volume will eventually decrease. And so we'll leverage the continue utilizing a third-party call center to support our calls in lieu of filling vacancies. Call center staff, again, will continue to report in person on a rotational basis to support our customers that are coming into the main lobby. And then, of course, there is that potential to relocate our remaining in-office staff to come back to the main office. Any questions?
You know, I think I do have a question that I didn't before. If an employee says, I want to work at the headquarters, I want to work here, would that be accommodated?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
So we have had some staff that have opted out. We have a couple of folks that support our front counter, and they really love the engagement. They like to come in. They like to engage with customers. They like to engage with their peers. So we have had, you know, couple of people that said, I prefer at this time to work in the office, and we are acknowledging that and accommodating that.
Yeah, okay, I like the approach, and I think it's well thought out.
Thank you.
Any other comments or questions? Director Armstrong?
Yeah, I just compliment you on the approach and what you're doing. I think if there is a function that really lends itself well to this, it's that type of, you know, job, and I think this just shows a lot of innovation and leadership, what you're doing. So
thank you.
That's good.
No, very good. I just wanted to say, and I failed to do this when you briefed the admin committee, but thank you for the hard work that you put into this. It seems easy. We'll come up with a work from home program, but there's a lot of moving parts to it. So I just want to acknowledge the job you and your team did of actually coming up for this with the district. It is the wave of the future. I think it makes it more attractive to attract talent to the district when given this option with stay-at-home moms or stay-at-home dads or stay-at-home anybody. So, again, thank you for doing the work to put this together. I think it really enhances the customer experience for the district. So,
thank you very much.
Very good. Thank you very much. Thank you, Charles. Appreciate that. And our final informational item for the day is an update on the commercial, industrial, and institutional non-functional turf. Good morning.
Good morning, President Pauley and members of the board. So as we continue to discuss, we are in very challenging hydrologic conditions. with dry conditions persisting both on our state water project and our Colorado River supplies. There have been a variety of actions both at the local, state, and regional levels, but this morning I'm going to focus on our response and our actions associated with non-functional turf, specifically with our CII customer base. So, as I mentioned, our historic dry conditions persist on both of our imported water supplies, and about a year ago, the governor asked for a 20% reduction based on 2020 usage across the board from all water suppliers. This spring, the governor took additional action by executing the executive order requiring the State Water Resources Control Board to adopt emergency regulations by May. That executive order that was signed in the spring required water agencies to advance to their level two of their water shortage contingency plans. It encouraged agencies to go above and beyond that 20% ask that he had established back in July. Also enacted plans to ensure the achievement of the reduction of 20% and directed the Department of Water Resources to develop strategies to improve water conservation, and further directed state board staff to consider the adoption of a non-functional turf regulation. That was adopted and established in May of 2022, in which the state board passed a prohibition of irrigation of non-functional turf with potable water by CII customers. That prohibition on irrigation of non-functional turf applied to customers that are in the commercial, industrial, and institutional categories, and it focused on irrigation with potable water. It does allow for irrigation of trees and shrubs that are irrigated with the same device or valve, but it does exclude residential customers. However, it does apply to HOAs for common areas that have dedicated landscape meters. Parks and sports field and other recreational uses are excluded, as well as areas that are irrigated with recycled water. There's also an exclusion for turf that is certified as low water use that meets very specific criteria that's defined in the prohibition. Once the ban was being developed, EMWD sent an initial notification to all of our CII customers notifying them that we anticipated this ban taking effect. There was a follow-up letter sent to all the CII customers upon the ban taking effect, and this was to inform our customers of the mandate to discontinue irrigation of non-functional turf, but also providing that clarification that irrigating turf when it was shared with shrubs or trees was allowed, and that we also wanted to make sure that they were aware that there could be enforcement actions if they did not comply. In June, you adopted a change to our administrative code to provide that authority and also to reflect these emergency regulations. And you have also continued to approve consultant agreements to allow us to support and advance all of our water use efficiency initiatives, including the compliance with the ban. So as I mentioned, all of our CII customers have been contacted initially with mailings and also e-blasts to customers that do have email addresses. We also performed an initial investigation to really try to identify those areas within our service area that appeared to meet the intent of the ban. So those areas of our CII customers that appeared to only have areas of non-functional turf, no trees, no shrubs, again, candidates that were seeming to meet the intent of the ban. We did identify a variety of customers, approximately 100 CII customers that represented about 600,000 square feet of non-functional turf. We did direct outreach to a subset of that group initially, about a third of those, to encourage them to reduce or eliminate the watering of their non-functional turf. We're also working with another about 300 customers that we've identified as having non-functional turf, but also have other eligible irrigation, so working on ways to separate the irrigation so that they can reduce or eliminate the irrigation of the non-functional turf while maintaining the irrigation of the other plants and shrubs. We held the first of three CII workshops in the end of July to encourage compliance with the ban. There have been a variety of additional outreach activities, administrative staff presentations, Chamber of Commerce presentations. Our general manager, as he's out in the community, also takes every opportunity to highlight the ban and ask for participation and compliance, including meetings at WRCOG, the Moreno Valley Chamber, as well as the Moreno Valley Director's Advisory. Our PGA staff has also included this information in their presentations, Moreno Valley, City of San Jacinto, and City of Hemet. So what are we asking for from our CII customers? We're asking them to direct their landscapers to shut off irrigation to all eligible non-functional turf. And this is important because often the people that we meet out in the field are not necessarily the people paying the bills. And so we want to make sure that the property owners and property managers are providing the appropriate direction to their landscape management teams to ensure compliance. We also provided property owners and customers with a template letter that they could provide to their landscape entities. We also are encouraging our customers to continue to take advantage of the rebates and programs that EMWD offers. We have drip rebates. We offer landscape irrigation surveys. We have a large commercial landscape program. There's the Water Smart rebates that include the turf replacement, and also our accelerated retrofit program that provides incentives for conversion to recycled water. We've also wanted to make it very clear to HOAs that fines cannot be assessed for residents who are not maintaining turf during a drought declaration. So although this ban doesn't apply to residential customers, HOAs with dedicated landscape meters are under the ban, and again, we want to remind HOAs that they cannot impart fines on residents that are not watering their non-functional turf. How have our customers responded? So in tracking the water use of this group of CII customers, we have seen a reduction in water use by 63%. And staff is actively reaching out to customers requesting that they shut off irrigation to non-functional turf. We're doing weekly drive-bys, and we're also using our AMI data to monitor changes in water use behaviors. We've also developed, printed, and are distributing, doing our part signs to customers that have shut off their irrigation to their non-functional turf. As you'll see on the following slides, some examples of areas that are drying up. We've also offered those signs to customers that have already done their part by converting areas of non-functional turf to drought-tolerant landscaping. Several of our CII customers have been very active and willing to participate and comply, including our partnership with the Mount San Jacinto College. Right off the bat, they requested 12 of the drought signs for turned off irrigation to non-functional turf that's not being irrigated with recycled water. The Paris Unified School District also requested multiple signs as they've begun shutting off irrigation to their non-functional turf. And Valleywide, again, a great partner for us, has identified 3 sites initially. It doesn't seem like a lot, but Valleywide also uses a lot of recycled water. So, again, they're trying to look for opportunities to reduce their potable irrigation and have also requested signs to highlight their compliance as well. And again, we are seeing customers continuing to sign up for those rebates that I mentioned. Last month, our CII and MF, our DRIPS program had 31,000 square feet of area converted from spray to drip. And our large landscape voucher program, we saw 27 irrigation controllers installed, representing a total of almost 1,000 stations. So as I mentioned, here's some examples of our customers really stepping up and complying with our ask. There's a variety. We have both kind of all represented here. We have commercial, industrial, and institutional. And we have an additional efforts that are ongoing. We have two additional workshops that we're going to hold with CII customers. We are highlighting customer compliance through our social media and other promotional outlets using pictures like I noted, highlighting how people have turned off irrigation and the doing our part signs. We're continuing to identify areas of that are only irrigating non-functional turf, working with customers to assess options to, again, segregate those areas that have other uses for that potable water. And we are also assessing enforcement options for those customers that are electing not to comply or show effort. We will likely start with an issue of a letter of non-compliance, potentially assess a penalty, which is allowed by our admin code, consistent with the emergency regulation. But we also have water budgets in our toolkit that we can also adjust accordingly and only establish water budgets based on irrigation of areas with functional or drought-tolerant landscape. We'll continue to encourage customers to permanently replace that turf with more drought-tolerant landscape, again, taking advantage of the existing programs and rebates that are available. And we're also assessing the need for additional resources to support monitoring and compliance and coordinating with Metropolitan on future non-functional turf initiatives. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
And President Pauly, if I can maybe add, first, I really appreciate the effort by our team. You know, we have boots on the ground working with our customers in the community. And the reception we've had so far from our CII customers has been very positive. You know, whether it's at the workshop that was held, we had about 30 participants, or the interactions we've had in the field. Our customers, our CII customers, are responding in a very collaborative and positive manner, and we want to continue that. We're also, you know, beyond our efforts, we're messaging to others in the region our leading efforts on this, and we're going to be working with Metropolitan. Metropolitan has also put forward an item that they'll be discussing with their board on additional steps that they may be taking, whether it's additional financial incentives or potentially additional legislation that they may support. So we're going to be continuing to advocate to do the right thing on this issue, not only in our service area, but on a regional basis. And with that, we'll be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Director Record?
Questions and comments. Pretty robust discussion at Metropolitan the last couple of days about this issue. They were talking about reducing allocations to member agencies based on the amount of non-functional turf they have, which is very interesting. I brought up the point of what does an agency like ours do that has sub-agencies that get Metropolitan water through us. It's a very interesting concept. Also, they talked about rates and budgets, which, you know, we already have that ability. So, yeah, there's a lot of activity, a lot of momentum, and I want to keep it going. And I think we're one of the leaders, and I like that. I want to keep it that way. And I mentioned the letter that John Ensminger put out there related to the discussions about Colorado River issues. And I appreciate what they're doing, and they've been leaders for decades, and I think we have a relationship with them that I want to continue. And at some point, maybe we might consider just writing them a letter, you know, nothing fancy, but just say, hey, we agree with what you're doing, and we're one of the agencies in Southern California that takes us very seriously, and we're doing everything that we can. So I'm concerned with what I see in the city of Hemet. I'm not sure how seriously they're taking this. And because to me, there's no better message to send to everyone about the seriousness of this drought than to see turf that isn't usable no longer being irrigated. So it's water savings, and it's also a message, and hopefully it's something that's going to modify behavior going forward, hopefully forever, because this is the reality that we're faced with, and I'm very pleased to be part of this organization and part of what we're doing. So keep it up, step it up, whatever you need.
Thank you, Director Record.
I appreciate the outreach we're doing. I think it's important. You mentioned HOAs are being reminded they can't fine somebody for not watering their grass. The difficulty is, though, that once the drought is lifted, if and when, as a homeowner living in HOA, you might be concerned that you let your grass die, and then a year later, you have to replant it. You have to, you know, start watering it again, do something else, and they won't let you put in some alternative.
Well, I do. I probably need PGA to verify this, but my understanding is in our service area, we've worked with a lot of our HOAs to make sure that they allow conversion. I know that was a concern during the last drought, but I do believe we've made progress in that area, and a lot of the HOAs now do allow the conversion to non-functional turf. I don't live in the service area, but I know our HOA made that change after the last drought. So
that's good.
Yeah, so I have seen it, you know, community and regionally. So we'll confirm, though, to make sure we don't have any outstanding HOAs that don't allow for conversion.
Well, actually, what was in my mind is my adult son, who serves on the Beaumont Cherry Valley District, lives in an HOA, does not allow him to have an alternative, and he's been lobbying and screaming and crying, and to no avail.
One of the other things that was discussed at MET was legislation, and this could very well be a part of that. And also, the state board, which developed this, they're anxious to get feedback on what's happening on the ground, and this would be, I think, very valuable to let them know about this challenge going forward.
And I think the other important thing for us as, you know, community leaders is to continue the encouragement of the replacement, because not only, you know, will people revert back, but we also want our community to be beautiful. And I think that if people see the conversions versus dead grass, I think that it'll permanently change the behavior. And I think that's an important element as we, you know, go work through the emergency part of the regulation, also the encouragement and really working with our customers to make that replacement, because that is going to be the permanent change.
Director Armstrong.
Just clarification on the regulation. Could you go to the, you have a couple pictures in there, and there's of towards the beginning, there's grass. We'll keep going. There's, yeah, this one. So is that turf fall within this regulation or not?
So I guess, it would depend on a couple of things. So one, it would depend if there is a device that is segregated for irrigating only that portion of the turf, because there are obviously trees and shrubs. It also would depend on whether or not the community uses this for dog walking or other things. And that is one of the challenges when, you know, you're dealing with the definition of functional and non-functional. Because you're right. On, you know, by the letter of, okay, it's a median, it's really small area. They've obviously converted a lot of the other space. They left this for some reason. Was it intentional? Because there are people that walk their dogs. And again, that gets into the challenge of the definition. So I think it would depend. And we have had customers that have reached out when we've reached out and said, hey, it appears you have non-functional turf, and they've communicated, no, this is an area that people walk their dogs. Our community has told us that this is an area that they do use. So we have to find that right balance.
And if I can add, Director Armstrong, one of the things that we're looking at as well, beyond the what is exclusively non-functional turf that's served by a valve station, as Linnea mentioned, part of the exclusion is if you have trees or perennial shrubs. But one thing that we are looking at and working with our customers, although they technically may be falling under that exclusion or exception, we want to work with them to cap those sprinkler heads that essentially irrigate the non-functional turf versus allowing the irrigation of trees. So we think there's a reasonable approach here to address that those kind of situations, and we are having those conversations with our CIA customers. We've also, when this issue came up to the general manager that met, I raised the concept of using potentially funding from MET to separate the irrigation systems. You know, can MET step in and help us help our customers so that we are able to shut off those non-functional areas, knowing there's a cost to the customers to separate the irrigation system, potentially do other improvements? So we're having those conversations. We realize that ultimately we want to support not only functional use, but also trees and shrubs. We want to continue irrigating them. But there's ways around dealing with those areas that are common.
Good. I just want to make a quick comment. I think the last time you were up here, I looked across the street and thought, boy, there's some non-functional turf, and it looks like we're moving in the right direction over there.
We are. We've had conversations with the county. They lease, obviously, there's a property management firm. But I should point out also, President Pauly, that area is irrigated with recycled water.
Okay.
So technically, they're exempt from this, but we've elevated the issue to the county, making them aware. We would like to see them reduce or eliminate the irrigation of that turf.
I strongly believe that agencies and government agencies should lead the way on this. So if the county wanted to put some other type of landscaping in there, as Lia said, people see this and they get ideas for themselves rather than just dead grass. So I may continue to work on that myself, but I forgot that is recycled over there.
Yeah.
All right, very good. Thank you for a great presentation. Thank your team for it. I mean, I realize, again, going out, talking to all these people, it's a sea change of how they do business, and it's a tough message to get across, but it looks like we're making real progress on it. So I would say that's a real win. So thank you.
Appreciate
thank
it. You.
All right. That brings us to item 7 on our agenda, which is to receive and file various updates, reports. Can I get a motion, or does anyone have any questions?
Move approval.
Move approval of Director Record. Director Armstrong wanted to second that. May I get a roll call vote, please?
Director Pauly?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
Director Cronin?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
Passes 5-0. That will move us to item 8 this morning, which is our calendar review and director's attendance reports. Jennifer, good morning.
Good morning, President Pauly and members of the board. I have one event for your consideration today, which will be on Thursday, October 13, the Rivers and Lands Conservancy Dinner Awards Gala. That is 5:30 to 7:30 in October. So moving on to page 2 is the board member's master calendar. Please review the information and let me know if you have any changes for the upcoming 2 weeks. On to the top of page 3 are the current events and conferences that are scheduled over the next few weeks. Starting off with tomorrow, there are 2 events. At 7:30 in the morning in Temecula is the Southwest Regional Economic Summit, followed by the Moreno Valley State of the City Address at 11. So August 24th through the 26th in San Diego is the annual Urban Water Institute Conference. And on Wednesday, August 31st, is the Marietta Wildemar State of the City Address. And in September, on the 10th, there's actually 2 events that evening. One begins at 5:30, which is the Western Science Center, Science Under the Stars. And then beginning at 6:30 is the Marietta Wildemar Awards Gala. So September 14th through the 15th in Anaheim is the BIA Biz Show. That'll be at the Anaheim Convention Center. And then Thursday morning, September 15th, is the State of the District for the Riverside County Address. That'll be in Temecula. And then on Friday, September 16th, is the Orange County Water Summit in Anaheim. So all this information is in your packet at the back. One that I did forget to mention was on the 26th of August is the Riverside County Water Task Force discussion series, and their topic is the California drought. So, also, the Aqua Fall Conference, which is going to be November 29th through December 1st. The registration is open and available, so if anybody would like to attend, please make sure you let me know so I may register for you that event because it sells out quickly. Continuing on page 3 are the board meetings and board committee meetings for the next 3 months. I'd like to remind the board members that the executive committee that was normally scheduled on Thursday, September 15th, has moved to September 28th at 8:30 in the morning. And then continuing on page 4 is the rest of the board committee meetings for October, along with the interagency meetings that go through October, which are all on schedule. So, and then Monday, September 5th, the offices, EMWD offices, are closed for Labor Day. So, are there any questions regarding the calendar review?
Okay. Thank you very much,
that concludes
Jennifer.
My report. Thank you.
All right, we will go to director's attendance reports. We'll start with Director Armstrong.
Had my monthly update with the general manager, which is super informative and helpful, so I appreciate that. Attended the Eastern and Elsinore Valley Municipal Water District interagency meeting. Went over water supply, went over MET issues, went over our regional resiliency efforts. So that was a good meeting, and just want to add that their board really complimented the Eastern team and staff for what a great job they do in these meetings and providing information. So that was a nice compliment to staff for that. Quail Valley Community Group, Amanda and I went there. Amanda did all the presentation, though, and was an update on the status of the septic to sewer conversion project for that area, as well as they wanted an update on the Paris II desalter. I guess somebody there saw it on the news and wanted to know what exactly was happening. So she did a really good job with that update. I did not attend the Southern California Water Conference, but I did attend the Cal-DSAL Executive Committee on Monday. And they're really ramping up their efforts and communication to really talk about the benefits of both ocean and groundwater desal. And they really feel like this is a perfect time to create more awareness about it. Additionally, they're planning their annual conference, which will be in Sacramento in mid-February.
All right. Thank you very much, Director Corona.
Well, I actually don't have anything to report. The Rancho Water meeting that was scheduled for last week was canceled and is being held tomorrow at 11 o'clock after the economic forecast.
Very good. Thank you for that. I did have a meeting with both the Deputy General Manager and the General Manager, and those always go well and very helpful and informative. I attended the Winchester Municipal Advisory Council, and I will also note, it's not on here, but our finance team, we had some residents of the core downtown of Winchester, some property owners that were very interested in accelerating the sewer possibilities down there. So I set a meeting up with Laura and John Adams. We had a really productive one about what it would take and some options, but that is that was brought up again at the Winchester Municipal Advisory Council. So I think as development in Winchester occurs, there's more and more of interest in that core downtown and putting that on sewer. So probably more to come on that. Southern California Water Conference, I attended one of the sessions Craig Miller of Western was involved in, and I just say he is really becoming a passionate advocate for the projects of more storage, et cetera. Also a good lunch with the Met General Manager as the speaker. So a few people, Joe and a few people from Eastern attended. I thought it was a very good event put on by the Building Industry Association. Had the opportunity to talk to some builders who are more and more interested in, as we build out in our service area in particular, what can we do to be more water efficient and along those lines. Just there, this is the ground zero for building and housing, and they're very interested in the drought and just water efficiency in general. So that was a very good meeting to attend. And as Nick noted last night, we had a very successful meeting at City of Murrieta. So thank everybody for that. Director Record.
Yes. So joining the Orange County Caucus review of Met Agenda, which is good meeting, standing committee and board meetings Monday, Tuesday. I mentioned the discussion about non-functional turf initiatives. We continue to spend a lot of time on issues that are important but not directly related to how we're going to figure out what we, how we go forward with the drought, such as changes to the administrative code on ethics investigations. We spent an hour talking about a resolution that encourages people to be civil when they talk to the board, and couldn't get there without, you know, a lot of pushback by San Diego especially, and finally reworked it, and they wanted outside counsel to review it. It was just, it's just unbelievable. You'd never know that we're in the drought that we're in. But, you know, well, August is a month where we get assessed valuation information from all the counties, and that determines the voting rights that member agencies have. Ours always goes up, and it went up a little bit again this year. So, you know, continue to work on drought issues and Colorado River issues and state project issues. So it's the meetings have gotten really long. It was good to be there in person. There were seven directors there, and I think that would really help a lot if we get back to in-person meetings. Next week we have a six-hour workshop or forum or whatever you want to call it on diversity, equity, and inclusion, which is really important. But so anyway, member agencies are invited, and I assume that we'll have someone there. So we'll see that, how that goes. The chairwoman was able to make appointments for committees that were established many months ago that never got stood up because her appointments were blocked. So now we have an election for chair coming up in October, so lots of drama. And most of the drama is not related to the drought, which is unfortunate. So anyway, hopefully it gets better. EMWD meetings, monthly update with general manager. It's good and informative, and I appreciate it.
All right. Very good. Thank you for that. And also thank you for doing a great job for us at Met. I can feel it gets a little frustrating at moments, especially being in a drought and not spending the kind of time on the drought. Yeah. But so I do appreciate the fact that we have an outstanding representative of this agency on Met. Director Slauson.
Yes, thank you. I attended an update with the general manager and, of course, discussed district business. I attended the SAPA meeting yesterday, and we discussed had updates on cloud seeding and the homeless camp impact on water quality in the Santa Ana River, the results of the most recent study. And as it turns out, the pigs are the bigger problem. I guess there are a lot of pigs in the Santa Ana River. So I also attended the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce meeting on the 5th, and the speaker was Robin Steinbach. She's the president of the Moreno Valley RCC campus. And there was an update from the city. That's it.
All right. Very good. That brings us to directors' comments or future agenda items. Does any directors have any closing comments or ideas for future agenda items? Seeing none, I will ask legal counsel if there's need for closed session today.
There is not, Mr. Chair.
Very good. With that, we will stand adjourned until Wednesday, September 7th, 2022. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.